Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone.
I'm a little, I'm more disheveled than usual, I think. I'm always of a certain degree of dishevelment, but I think it's more evident today. I apologize if you came dressed with your A game.
Well, I got the coffee and we're doing morning, so those are two things going in my favor. But it is good to talk to you, Bill. We weren't here last week. We don't take a lot of time off. So, or if we do,
The hardest working online diet vlogger talking heads in the business.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the entire diet vlogging community, we are at the top in terms of our work, our output, and our work product. So,
might be the Lou Gehrigs or the Cal Ripken Juniors of the game.
That's right, the Iron Man of blogging.
But a few things have transpired since we took our break. Now, you had a piece this week. I see a lot of talk that Romney was right.
Yeah.
Romney was right about Russia. He called Russia our number one geopolitical foe in 2012. The left laughed at him. Obama mocked him in the foreign policy debate. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. And you had some thoughts about that.
Yeah, look, I think it's important context and to discuss like exactly this debate that you're talking about. So Romney was specifically said geopolitical threat. And I think that's the key. President Obama in that.
The
word that I'm obsessing over is geopolitical because President Obama obfuscated and attempted to conflate that. And he said during that last 2012 presidential debate, Obama mocked Romney saying, quote, "I'm glad that you recognize that Al-Qaeda is a threat, because a few months ago, when you were asked what's the biggest geopolitical threat facing America, you said Russia, not Al-Qaeda. You said Russia." In the 1980s, they're now calling to ask for their foreign policy back because, you know, the Cold War has been over for 20 years. So my point here is that President Obama was, I think, being very deceptive. If he had argued that, no, in fact, China is the greater geopolitical foe, then I think that would have been a much more interesting debate. But he basically attempted to essentially to imply that Romney is stuck in the 1980s, doesn't realize the Cold War is over, that the Soviet Union has collapsed, and frankly doesn't take Al-Qaeda as seriously as he ought to. It was an example of sleight of hand, in my opinion, that Obama engaged in. And in hindsight, I mean, I think Romney probably was right, and I'm not the only one to say so. I mean, the New Republic says that Romney was right. Dave Weigel says that Romney was right. This isn't like just a conservative revisionist thing. So I'll leave it there, and I know you have a different opinion, though.
it's not just conservatives saying that, although I think conservatives have been the most eager to talk about it. Oh my God, the New Republic said it too. Slate said it too, kind of thing. But it's not wholly in the sphere of conservatives. But I do think it is. I mean, I take your point that, you know, I mean, what Romney had said when pressed on it was there's a difference between Russia being the number one geopolitical foe and Al-Qaeda being the national security threat, and he said he had some other term, I think, for Iran and North Korea. He kind of put them all in little special boxes. So it didn't seem like he was, you know, ranking everything in a rigid way. And so Obama did kind of blur that in his comment there. But I think Romney had some comments that seemed to deorbitize going after Bin Laden in Pakistan. So I think Obama had some grist to work with there. But more importantly, as far as was Romney right about Russia, I think you got to pull the lens back even wider, because Romney made that comment in 2012, building on previous comments he made in 2010, to criticize Obama for trying to reset our diplomatic relationship with Russia. You're going even farther. Bush comes in 2001 saying, I've seen the Putin's soul, and he's a man of his word, blah, blah, blah. That relationship deteriorates over the course of the Bush presidency, and at the end of the Bush presidency, Putin invades Georgia and effectively picks off a couple provinces there. Palin in 2008 blamed Obama's response for being indecisive and morally relativist, even though it was on Bush's watch. It's like Bush, you know, sent in the cavalry at that point either. But then Obama comes in talking about a reset.
Right.
And one part of that was plans to recalibrate Bush's missile defense plans. Bush had a plan for long-range missile defense based in Poland that Russia was very unhappy about. And over the course of Obama's term, it got finalized actually after the election. But, you know, it came up in 2012 because there was that hot mic moment when Obama said to Medvedev, give me a little space here. I'll have more flexibility after the election on missile defense that Romney pounced on. So Obama has, you know, scrapped that long-range missile defense plan in Poland. There's other short-range and medium-range stuff there. But as the Obama administration said, it's geared towards Iran, North Korea. It's not geared toward Russia. It never was geared toward Russia. And if there's a side benefit that improves our diplomatic relations with them, well, that's fine. That's the Obama line. The Romney line was, this is a type of appeasement towards Russia. It's naive towards Russia. They're our number one geopolitical foe. And we should not care if they're antagonized by that missile defense.
But let me just jump in.
Well, I'll finish it up later.
Okay.
You challenge that part.
All right. So no, I just wanted to sort of start with the, so Romney, though, it is important to note, Romney was mocked for suggesting that Russia was the number one geopolitical foe. And Obama and others really used this as a method of ridicule to sort of cast him as being stuck in a 1980s, you know, paradigm. But I do want to read something that Romney's foreign policy director, Len He Chen, said in a statement, which I think explains Romney's point much better than he did, which is, I'm quoting now, Russia's nuclear arsenal, its energy resources, its geographic position astride Europe and Asia, the veto it wields in the UN Security Council, and the creeping authoritarianism of its government make Russia a unique geopolitical problem that frustrates progress on numerous issues of vital concern to the United States. So that was in 2012. And I mean, I think, you know, you could argue whether they're, you know, a bigger foe than China. But I think that's a compelling argument. I think clearly Obama's equating al-Qaeda to that is obfuscation. And then I would say, going more specifically addressing the notion that Obama has somehow invited what has happened in Ukraine and Crimea, is that, you know, yes, I think Georgia was, you know, America basically did nothing. George W. Bush is not a hero, certainly in this regard, and the whole looking in Putin's eyes thing is absurd. But then Obama comes in and does the reset. But I think you have to put it in context. There's also been Syria, you know, the red line that was laid down by Obama and then crossed with really no ramifications. I think, in other words, it's Georgia, it's Syria, it's other things, I think, that have created this situation now where I think you really can look back and say, Romney sort of saw Russia, the bear, as a bigger threat, and Obama seemed to just sort of dismiss and downplay them.
Well, I mean, I still dispute that for a couple other reasons, and gave it to this missile defense point. You know, Romney was very focused on that in 2012, but those missile defense plans were in place in 2008. You know, Bush was that and Russia was mad about it then. They weren't so intimidated by it that they didn't invade Georgia. They didn't care that that wasn't part of the equation, whether or not they were going to encroach Georgia's sovereignty. And so I think if Obama kept that now, it wouldn't have made a difference how Putin was going to enter into the Ukraine. And number two, Romney's point about Russia, you know, constantly obstructing at the UN is largely true, but he blows right past what happened with Libya in 2011 when Obama's and actually Hillary's diplomacy with Russia was successful, and they agreed to having a UN-backed mission to help the Libyan people and prevent Gaddafi from massacring his people when they were in the midst of their revolution. That's not an insignificant diplomatic win. And so if Romney was treating them as the number one foe from the get-go, you never would have gotten that kind of deal. So I don't think it was wise to treat them as a foe up and down the line. I think I don't, and it doesn't mean that you have to be naive about Russia either. I don't think Obama's been soft on Russia. I don't think they've assumed Russia's the good guys in every circumstance. I think they've dealt with them in a very kind of utilitarian, cold, calculating kind of way. And the bottom line, that is the Ukraine. It's not like Obama's gone to the Ukraine saying, okay, Putin, have your way with Ukraine. Obama was actively supporting the Ukrainian people who want to get out of Russia's orbit. In fact, Russia tapped our diplomat's phone line, the famous, you know, F the EU phone call from a month ago. That was a call about trying to get the Russian-backed government to accept a power-sharing deal so they could actually economically integrate with the European Union. And when they won that fight, they actually not only ousted the president, but selected as prime minister the person that the U.S. was talking up in that leaked phone call. It was then that Putin said, okay, I got to save face here. I'll try to take off a piece of the Ukraine. It's not like it was because Obama was rolling over. It's because Obama was getting in his face. So I just don't see the whole framework that Romney was talking about, I think, doesn't mesh with what's actually happened. I think Obama's been case by case with Russia, not soft on Russia, whereas Romney would have been, based on his rhetoric, very, very rigid and might have missed opportunities that where Russia actually was helpful.
So, I mean, you know, it's how you view Russia. I mean, I think we should view them incredibly skeptically. I think that you know, and maybe, you know, I'm sure Obama would probably accuse me of being a child of the 80s or something.
But he does view Russia skeptically. That's what, I don't think you and him disagree on that point. It's a question of, you know, how skeptical. It's so, I mean, it's like Democrats and talking about the House Republicans. You know, a lot of Democrats say, you know, forget it. You know, they'll never agree to anything. Don't even bother. You should just have a policy, a campaign position, and take it to the election. Where Obama says, no, you know, I know these guys are tough customers, but if I keep pushing me, I'll get a win here and there. I mean, I think that's somewhat analogous to his approach to Russia. I'm not saying Boehner is right. Putin.
But
it's not like he just does what Russia wants to do all the time. And I mean, I think Ukraine is you know, ground zero of that.
My sense is, Bill, that Obama has been wavering. He has, you know, issues threats that are promptly ignored, and there are no repercussions, and that's a credibility problem. I think there's a lack of moral clarity, and so I think there's a leadership problem with President Obama, and you know, I don't know if that would have or wouldn't have prevented what happened, you know, in Ukraine or in Crimea, but I do think that Putin, I mean, the guy's a friggin' KGB colonel. I mean, the notion that, you know, and this idea that he's like erratic now, or I mean, that's baloney. I mean, I think he's behaving exactly as you would expect the authoritarian thug, I mean, nationalist to act. I mean, and I think he sees, I think he sees an Obama weakness. Now, there are some conservatives, as you know, Bill, who, like, admire Putin and, like, kind of wish. In fact, I guess Rudy Giuliani recently said some stuff on that about that. That's not the camp that I fit in. But I do think that Putin maybe exploits this lack of clarity and the fact that, you know, you can't say, you can't issue warnings and say, don't cross this line, and then people cross it with impunity and nothing happens to them. That,
well, I mean, you and I are never going to agree on this point, yeah. But obviously I think there is a point of debate whether the Syrian red line episode was a case of weakness or strength. Was the red line drawn and ignored, or was the red line drawn and held based on the agreement that was finally cut? Just this past week, Obama was asked about that by Jeffrey Goldberg of Bloomberg, who did an interview with him in preview of Netanyahu's visit to the U.S. and they asked about Iran, you know, can people take your word for what happened in Syria? And Obama was like, what are you talking about? We drew the red line. We said that you cannot use chemical weapons with impunity. We got the deal in place, and now those weapons are being moved out. And I know there's some talk about being too slow, but Obama said it's actually working on not on a perfect timetable, but the progress is moving forward from his perspective, and he's not overly concerned about them not being moved out. Again, you can agree or disagree on that point. I would just note that, you know, from Obama's perspective, he is making the argument that what I say what I mean, I've proved I say what I mean, and that holds not only for, say, Obama bin Laden or for Libya, but also with Syria.
Okay,
let's
talk about, I do want to address Syria real quick. I mean, as you'll remember, first he, you know, said that the line in the sand, the red line, whatever. Okay, but it wasn't just that. Then John Kerry, his Secretary of State, paints this as like an existential crisis, as of a moral crusade tantamount to World War II. That this was like the Holocaust. So it's a moral imperative that we do something. Then Obama doesn't unilaterally decide to do nothing or to outsource it to the Russians, who, by the way, had been lecturing us in a Putin op-ed about, you know, diplomacy and not invading other countries, which, of course, is highly ironic. But before we outsource it to them, Obama doesn't, like, take the strong leadership position and say, look, we're not going to intervene. He decides to go to Congress with it, which was a complete disconnect. I mean, you could argue that going to Congress was always the right thing to do constitutionally, but it's discordant when you have just painted this as a moral crisis tantamount to World War II. And this guy's essentially, you know, essentially Hitler. And so I still argue that what happened, that Syria was a complete debacle, and it was very much signaling weakness and wavering. And that invites provocation.
Well, we'll leave that debate there. but I do want to talk a little bit about, so how is the Republican Party dealing with this now? I mean, I think there is a history of Republicans, you know, just taking the opposite view on foreign policy, you know, whether it was Clinton and Bosnia, or whether it was Obama and Libya. Obama taking the, you know, we will go into Pakistan view in 2008, you know, the more militaristic view there, and McCain and Palin beating him up about that, which was sort of weird.
And Hillary too, right?
What's that?
And Hillary too.
Well, Hillary, I mean, they're Democrats that did too. McCain, the hawkish of the hawks.
Yeah,
you know, was reticent about that, of all things.
Let me say, Huckabee, first of all, interestingly, for what it's worth, Huckabee was with Obama on that one. Mm-hmm. No one remembers that. It's sort of an asterisk, but it is interesting. But look, I think that there's a difference between saying you were going to invade, you know, Pakistan's airspace or whatever, and their sovereignty, and doing it, right? So, in other words, I would say that for the sake of diplomacy, it is not helpful to telegraph to Pakistan that you would go in there. Now, if I'm the president and I have, you know, very good intelligence telling me that bin Laden's in Abbottabad and we can take him out, I'm gonna do that, you know, I'm gonna do that. So in other words, you know, in foreign policy, there's a lot of deception and you don't always telegraph what you're actually going to do. So the fact is Obama may have done some harm diplomatically by saying that he, even though I would say that John McCain very well may have done the same thing. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I understand what you're saying. All I know is Obama said what he meant and did what he said he was going to do.
That's true. In this case, that is true.
But how is this affecting, how are Republicans handling this now? Because there's certainly some, again, there was this Romney view that, you know, that Putin is the worst of the worst and we should be sticking it to him. And there's this other line that seems to be, you know, suggested by Buchanan and Giuliani that, you know, Putin's the kind of leader that we should be impressed by, and Obama's a big softy, and, you know, at least Putin hates gays, and that's good. You gotta like that. you have Rubio out there laying out his Ukraine 5-point plan. You have McCain, seems practically blew a gasket at the APEC conference this week about Putin. But you have Rand Paul saying, hey, GOP, you shouldn't be tweaking Russia so much. You know, we should be skeptical of Russia, but this is much better relationship than we had during the Cold War. We don't feel like we were the world's on the precipice. You know, we should be thankful that we have a better relationship now than 20 years ago. Who's winning this argument within the Republican Party?
Well, first let me step back and be a little philosophical, then I'll put my political analyst hat on. But it is interesting that there is a sense, there's sort of two competing things happening in conservatism. One is, you could certainly argue that as a conservative, I should identify with Islamists and authoritarians. You could say, like, for example, you know, hey, if these are, you know, let's take Islamists. You know, you could say, hey, these are, it's a traditional culture. These are traditional folks. They're religious. I'm religious. And, you know, we should have something in common. And you could say the same thing with Putin right now, that, you know, he's a traditionalist. He's worried about the culture. I'm worried about the culture. And maybe you have to break some eggs to make an omelet. I mean, that's not how I view it, but that, I guess there are some people who see it that way. I also think there is just a thing where there are some people who hunger for leadership and they see Putin. And you know, maybe there's like an authoritarian strain in conservatism that they admire. And I guess I would suppose it is easier to demonstrate leadership when you basically, or a tyrant. American system's a little bit hard. I'm of a different school, which is to say an American conservative is in many ways a different animal. And so we're the biggest foes of Islamism and of authoritarianism. And so it makes, to me, it's very consistent that you would have conservatives be the people who want to stand up to radical Islam the most, or who want to stand up to Russia the most. But I guess you could argue it either way. To specifically answer your political question, Bill, I think that in politics, the terrain and the question is more important than the answer. And so what's happening in the world and the political environment in itself could determine, you know, who the nominee is. And it's still a long way away. And foreign policy tends to, you know, we're not talking about Syria much anymore. Foreign policy tends to come and go sometimes. But having said that, I mean, I think that there are certain people right now domestically who are winners from the fact that there's a foreign policy crisis going on. And I think that you could put Marco Rubio in that camp. He had a horrible 2013 with immigration reform. And, you know, this year he's already done, he was at the DMZ. He's done this Asia trip that was well received. He was very eloquent and outspoken about what's happening in Venezuela. And now with Ukraine, I think he is much better positioned to talk about this than the governors, whoever he thinks we need a governor, or someone like Rand Paul, who I think this certainly hurts. You know, there was a sort of anti-interventionist zeitgeist, there happening for a moment. I think right now the winds have shifted toward a more interventionist, America's a beacon of hope world. That favors Rubio. I think it also favors Ted Cruz, who's really balanced it. He's been very careful not to come out on either side of this sort of thing. But anything that hurts Rand Paul, I argue, helps Ted Cruz because they're in the same division. So, again, it's early, but I think that right now, you know, Marco Rubio has his mojo back, and I think Rand Paul's probably maybe hurt the most out of this.
I mean, do we have any kind of polling that lets us know that the interventionist wing of the Republican Party is ascendant versus the isolationist wing of Rand Paul? I mean, certainly for the last year, there, you know, Rand Paul was getting a lot of mojo, talking about excessive government, going after the NSA, you know, questioning intervention in places like Syria. Is it just that it's Russia? Does that just sort of push a button with certain Republicans that reminds them, oh, right. We actually like this stuff. We like to oppose these people.
Right. Well, I guess a few things. One, nobody's calling for any sort of military intervention, or at least very few people are. But
Even McCain. I saw McCain's APAC speech. He was shaking his fist. He threw out there, military options are impossible. Like, what are you so upset about? Give the guy a few days to work out what kind of sanctions he can put together. Jeez.
I mean, the most I've heard is talk of like NATO military exercises in the region. But I mean, mostly we're talking about, you know, essentially freezing the assets of top Russians. We're talking about, you know, imposing sanctions and moral clarity, just sort of condemning it in a very strong evil empire sort of way, and doing it very quickly. I mean, I think that's what's missing from Obama's leadership, in my opinion. It's not that he should have, like, sent in troops necessarily, but it's immediately condemning and strong, you know, and taking immediate action in the form of sanctions and whatnot. But having said that, I mean, no, this is anecdotal. And I think he's still, you know, the polling I have seen says that most Americans are, you know, probably not paying that much attention to this and certainly do not want any sort of an intervention. But I think when you look at Republican primary voters, and I think as this thing escalates, just anecdotally speaking, I mean, if people are talking about Russia and if the news is talking about Russia invading sovereign countries, then I think that Republicans all of a sudden become much more hawkish. I think that that if they're not, if we're talking about Afghanistan and Iraq as dominant news stories, you know, a war-weary America and a war-weary Republican Party become much, much more anti-interventionist. And that can't help but impact how one views Marco Rubio versus Rand Paul.
Well, certainly, you know, I think Rand Paul has been, you know, trying to be more strategic and delicate how he talks about these things as opposed to his father.
Yeah, do you have that? We were talking earlier, Bill. Do you have the Rand comments?
Andy, let me pull them back up.
Okay.
I can jabber until I get them.
Yeah, I mean, basically, Rand is still, I mean, the last that I heard is still basically saying, essentially saying this isn't really our business. Eastern Europe, this is their region.
This is from February 24th.
Okay, so it's a couple weeks.
And so I guess that's before the military incursion into Ukraine. So I'm not. I would need to check to see if he said something more recent.
Well, go ahead and read it. I think it could still be used against them. Whether or not,
right, I'm sure.
Even though it's out of context, but still, it could still be used against him in an ad or something.
I see a statement he's made a few days afterwards, but on the 24th, he said, "Someone our side are so stuck in the Cold War era that they want to tweak Russia all the time, and I don't think that is a good idea."
Right.
The Ukraine has a long history of either being part of the Soviet Union or within that sphere. I don't think it behooves us to tell Ukraine what to do. I'm not excited about saying, hey, let's put Ukraine in NATO to rub Russia's nose in it. We need to be conscious of the fact that Russia has intercontinental ballistic missiles. Though the Cold War is largely over, I think we need to have a respectful, to some adversarial, but respectful relationship with Russia. I mean, I feel like that is like,
that could
like
be
directly soft. Like, oh my God, they have missiles. Don't make them upset.
Well, that could be Barack Obama. I mean, like,
I don't think Obama says anything like that. Obama hasn't said, I think they're awful, but they have missiles pointed at us.
Take out the missile part. But I mean, the rest of it, I think if you had said that that was Obama, I wouldn't have been surprised.
No, I mean, again, I think Obama is trying to have as productive a relationship with them as possible, but not at the expense of, you know, abrogation of American principles, as Ukraine has shown. And he certainly wouldn't have been in the context of we need to be afraid of them because they have weaponry.
Right.
We have a few missiles of our own. But a few days afterwards, on February 28th, Paul said, "We live in an interconnected world. The United States has a vital role in the stability of that world." It's the non isolationist beginning. "The U.S. should make it abundantly clear to Russia that we expect them to honor the December 1994 Budapest Memorandum, in which the U.S., Russia, and the United Kingdom reaffirm their commitment to respect the independence and sovereignty and existing borders of Ukraine. Russia should also be reminded that stability and territorial integrity go hand in hand with prosperity. Economic incentives align against Russia's military involvement in Ukraine. Russia, which has begun to experience the benefits of expanded trade with the World Trade Organization, should think long and hard about honoring their treaty obligations and fostering stability that creates prosperity for its citizens. Most importantly, Russian intervention in Ukraine would be dangerous for both nations and for the rest of the world." So, you know, something like that, you know, if that was Obama in 2008, Sarah Palin would call that indecisive morally relativist, I assume. Although at the time, actually, Obama had threatened Russia's involvement with WTO because of the invasion in Georgia. So that doesn't seem to be the zeitgeist today, or at least from what you might get from, you know, chatter on conservative talk shows and whatnot. I guess I'm still unclear. Is there an underlying isolationist sentiment that still is significant that we haven't heard much in the press right now, but might still be around by the time primary season comes?
Well, Bill, as we tape this, CPAC is set to begin here in Maryland. Let's be honest; it's like when the It's like when the Redskins play and they show like, and here's a shot of the Washington Monument. It's like, yeah, it would take you about 2 hours to get there if you were to drive in rush hour.
Thought CPAC was back in D.C., though.
No, sadly, no. It's in Maryland now. It's in National Harbor, which is right across the river from Alexandria, Virginia. But you can't metro there. Nobody ever goes. Nobody I know would ever go there, like, unless they had to for a conference. So it's in Maryland.
Is this just saving money?
It's a really nice new facility. I think they probably got a better deal, but like CPAC had been doing it at the Wardman Park Hotel or something, like by the National Zoo. And that's sort of an old hotel, and they just, you know, the facilities were not state of the art. And so now they're doing it in a beautiful, amazing place that no one goes to. And that isn't Metro. I mean, there will be shuttle buses running from Union Station, but anyway, it's not exactly convenient to get to for folks like me. But anyway, my main point is, so let's see. Here's my guess. My guess is the CPAC speeches don't tell us anything about this. I bet you it's about Obama. You know, I bet you it's most of the applause lines or whatever are about Obamacare and stuff like that. My guess is that this has not yet become a big enough deal that it would that the shadow would sort of hang over CPAC, and that all the speeches would have to sort of comport with this being the dominant topic. Maybe I'm wrong, but my guess is that it's Obamacare and, you know, that sort of thing.
Now, we had these primaries in Texas yesterday. I haven't followed it that closely, but I guess there are some folks who are deemed Tea Party, some folks who are deemed establishment, and the Tea Party approach like, didn't do well. And so I somebody to say is this the decline of the Tea Party, yada, 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 which I generally don't disagree with. I do think the Tea Party is is on the outs, but I wonder if this is really an example of that, because it's not like being a Texas establishment person is all that moderate.
Right.
I mean, if John Cornyn is your establishment example, is this really some sort of swing to the center here?
Well, Bill, it's not even that. It's not only that Cornyn and Sessions aren't that bad as conservatives, but it's also the fact that if you look at the actual slate of candidates running, and like Railroad Commission or all these seats, very conservative candidates won. You had an example where Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, who was primaried by Ted Cruz and Dewhurst ran against each other in the Senate primary 2 years ago. Dewhurst came in second. I believe he came in second. In any event, he's in a runoff and he's in dire danger. He will probably now lose, I would suspect. If the incumbent Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst is in a runoff, it probably does not bode well. Remember, he actually had more votes by a pretty good margin than Ted Cruz in the Senate primary, but he didn't get 50%. It went to a runoff, and Cruz trounced him. So I suspect the history will repeat itself. You also had incumbent Ralph Hall, who is a conservative congressman, but he's 90 years old, forced into a runoff by, I think it was a conservative talk radio guy, who maybe I'm getting it wrong. But anyway, by a conservative who had a lot of money. So in any event, to cast this as a win for the establishment over the Tea Party would be facile. Having said that, there were two marquee races which were nationalized, which got a lot of attention. And in both those cases, the Tea Party candidate ended up looking horrible. The first you mentioned was John Cornyn's victory over Congressman Steve Stockman, who ran a bizarre campaign. The other was Congressman Pete Sessions' victory over Tea Party leader Katrina Pearson. And Katrina Pearson was actually endorsed by Sarah Palin and by Ted Cruz's father, Rafael Cruz. And she got trounced. During the race, it came out that she had been arrested years ago for shoplifting. It also came out that she had, while working for Ted Cruz, she had received unemployment benefits just a couple years ago from the state of Texas. And so these were two sort of high-profile conservative candidates, one of them a congressman, one of them endorsed by Sarah Palin, who ran against more establishment Republicans who were trounced. And so because these were the marquee races, it's pretty easy to sort of label this as the Empire Strikes Back. But in actuality, a lot of Texas conservatives did pretty well, just not the fringy ones.
So you don't think this is going to shape a discussion at CPAC this year, whether or not the Tea Party is ascendant or in the decline, that this is not going to be what dictates that discussion?
I don't think so, but I do think, Bill, that you could say that there is a trend at work here, and that trend is that Tea Party conservative candidates who are not vetted, who are not serious, are not going to win just because they have Sarah Palin's endorsement or Ted Cruz's dad's endorsement. Okay. So a lot of conservatives and a lot of Tea Party folks won, but the people who didn't were the candidates who shouldn't. And in the past, we've seen candidates who shouldn't win, who weren't properly vetted, win the not, you know, say like a Christine O'Donnell managed to win. I think what's happened is there's been a little bit of a pushback where people are saying, okay, just because you say you're Tea Party, just because you say you're conservative, we need to look a little bit at your credentials. And in the case of Katrina Pearson, her interesting background, I think, hurt her a couple years ago. It wouldn't have hurt Christine O'Donnell. So I think national supporters are much less likely to jump in. Now, you know, FreedomWorks supported Katrina, I think, but she didn't get the broad, you know, support of the conservative movement that she might have gotten a couple years ago. This is bad news for people like Matt Bevin, who's running in Kentucky, and Milton, what's his name, Obama's second cousin,
Wolf.
Milton Wolf, is running in Kansas. This is potentially bad news for them because they're running against establishment Republicans, but they've not been able to get the conservative movement to coalesce around them. And I think that what happened in Texas may be a harbinger of things to come in that regard, which I would argue is a positive development. I'm all for ousting rhinos and taking on, you know, squishy Republicans, but you need a couple things at play to do that. Like, one, you need a villain, but two, you need a hero. And I think the conservative movement and the Tea Party has learned generally that having one of these ingredients isn't enough. And just because somebody's running against a guy who's not perfect doesn't mean that they're perfect either. You have to vet them and see how they check out.
So as you go to CPAC tomorrow, are there things that you're looking for? Are you trying to gauge the temperature of the conservative movement? Are there certain internal debates you want to see try to get resolved there? When I was there, I was there one time several years ago, I didn't see a lot of internal discussion. It felt very one way to me. You're being dictated to from the stage what the messages should be. But maybe it's different now. Maybe there's a sense of more soul searching that's happening out of the open at these events. But are there certain things you're looking for or trying to assess when you're there?
So, I mean, for me, it's almost like a perfunctory thing. I mean, you sort of have to go. I think the way to do it is to go and not try to produce a lot of content, not try to write a lot while you're there, to sort of just take it in and get a sense of things. But it's a bit of an artificial environment. I mean, honestly, I get more from going to, in the past couple of months, I've been to several off-the-record meetings where I hear prominent candidates talk and I hear them take Q&A that's off the record. And then sometimes I get to meet with them privately afterwards. And you can really get a much better sense of things. There's a great quote from that I heard a couple years ago from Blues Traveler, you know, the band Blues Traveler. And they said they learned, you know, they went to school to learn about music. And the thing they learned is that the blues is like a baby crying. You know, the first time a baby cries, that's the blues. Afterwards, they learn that if they cry, you'll pick them up. And he says, so the first time a baby cries, that's the blues. Afterwards, it's all show business. And I think CPAC is a lot of show business. I mean, it's a production and you're going to, you know, the people who come to it are not normal. So you're not going to get a normal sense of Joe Sixpack voter. And the stuff you see on stage is a show. And so, you know, I'm going to sort of go and just take it all in without a lot of expectations. But I would say that in terms of informing my opinion, it's not one of the more important events, you know, just because it's become such a big deal that that you can no longer sort of get a realistic or accurate sense unless somebody messes up, right, and says something. It seems to me that, like, the most interesting moments that have come from CPAC have been, like, Andrew Breitbart yelling at people out front or getting in fight, you know, arguments with people or confrontations on camera. Or, you know, a few years ago, I guess it was in 2008, when Sam Brownback's people allegedly dressed up as Flipper the Dolphin and followed Mitt Romney around. That's a sort of like performance art stuff you get out of it. But if you care about the speeches, I would suggest watch it on C-SPAN. So that's sort of my take. I got into I wrote a sort of tongue in cheek, semi satirical piece a few years ago. You may recall, Bill, titled "No, I will not. No, I probably won't meet with you at CPAC."
Right.
And I went back and read it recently, and it's hard to read that and not think the person who wrote it's a jerk. And so when I go to CPAC, it's an interesting experience because people sometimes remind me of that piece. So,
well, I'll be watching on C-SPAN. I'm sad to say I can't make the trip.
Yeah.
All the potential 2016ers are going to, you know, do a turn, right?
I don't know about all of them. Interestingly, Chris Christie's invited this year. He'll be speaking. He was not invited last year. Donald Trump will be there. By the way, as an aside, I actually ate at Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's very nice restaurant in Palm Beach. where BuzzFeed's McKay Coppins spent a little time, famously a couple months ago. And let me say, if Donald Trump ran his campaign operation in the way that he runs that restaurant, I would probably be supporting him. It's quite nice and quite professional. Those are, you know, that's my milieu, Bill. I would cover the campaign from Palm Beach, given my druthers. But sometimes you have to
get a little dirty.
You go to CPAC, you dance with the one that brung you, as Reagan said. And by the way, I've been going to CPACs since 1999. I've been to almost all of them. I think
is this your 15th CPAC?
I don't know. I there's like one or two years I didn't go, but basically, I've been to almost everyone since 1999. So I'm celebrating some sort of an anniversary. I think it's probably like my 13th attended, my 15th year of going to CPACs, and I can say I've never paid for one, and I take great pride in that. But anyway, we'll keep you posted. And so follow me on Twitter at Matt K. Lewis, and I'll be tweeting stuff. I don't think I'm going to go on Friday, but Thursday looks like the hot day to go, so I'm going to plan on being there.
All right, well, we'll have much to talk about in its aftermath next week, I think.
You got it. We'll do a post-CPAC post-mortem.
All right.
All right, man. See ya.
Good to talk to you, sir.
Good talking to you. Check us out on Twitter at DMZ, on Facebook /DMZ Show. Good to be back, and looking forward to... more DMZs in the future, Bill.
All right.
All right, man.
Take care.
See ya.